Thank you. So I recognise many people in the audience who I know either from medicine or from being responsible for the climate change research programme in DFID, Late Lamented, or elsewhere. So I'm really looking forward to the debate on this, which I think will be very well informed, given the audience. The points to make are relatively straightforward ones. I mean, the first, which we just have to say, because it is obvious to everyone in this audience, but I'm afraid it is not obvious to absolutely everybody who's involved in policy, is the negative effects of climate change are very substantial. I'm trying to go up a slide. This is what happens when I'm allowed to do my own slides. Good, that's the one. Actually, thank you very much. It's widely accepted that the effect on climate change is one of the greatest threats to human health. That, I think anyone who's looked at that long term doesn't dispute that. Obviously, in the short term, there are very, very many very major impacts on health. In the short to medium term, you could argue that X or Y is more pressing. But if you take a long term view, then that changes. And the reason for that, and this is widely accepted by WHO and most other major health bodies, so this is, in terms of the established view among scientists who've looked at this, this is not a particularly controversial statement. The reason that this is really important is that for a great many of the health problems that we face out with climate change, we can reverse out of them or counter them in relatively short order. Climate change effects, once they take effect, are not going to be reversed in the foreseeable future. So the area under the curve for these changes is substantial. Even if the effect itself appears modest, a modest effect for an almost infinite period in terms of human existence, is actually a potentially very major effect. So the area under the curve is very substantial. The negative effects on climate change on health are obviously not distributed evenly globally. And there are multiple reasons for this, but I'll broadly divide them into reasons of the science of it, the biology, the atmospheric physics and various other areas, and reasons of economic and social development. Just start off with the scientific reasons. I've just taken two examples, and I could have taken many. If we see, as a result of climate change, as we will, a change and probably an increase in the destructive power of storms, it is fairly predictable, at least in the short to medium term, where they will be. They'll be where storms are already. On the left is a map of all the hurricanes and typhoons between 1816 and 2015. If you're in the Caribbean, if you're on the eastern seaboard of India, if you're in parts of Southeast Asia, the impact of this will be absolutely massive. Much less so if you're in multiple other areas, including large swathes, for example, of Africa and much of Europe. So this is a geographical fact that some areas will be affected more by that particular element of climate change. And there are many others where you can pick them out. And on the right here, I've taken a slightly different one. This is from the IPCC. And this is changes in consecutive dry days. Now, this does not translate straightforwardly to drought, and it does not translate from drought straightforwardly to hunger and then to famine. But nevertheless, there is a broad correlation. And as you can see, again, over what, depending on what time scale you talk about and what temperature rise we get to, this is distributed differently in different parts of the world. So these are, and I could repeat this over many different factors, there are biological and physical reasons why the geographical distribution is not going to be even everywhere. But this is going to be exacerbated by the fact that there is also much greater vulnerability to the effects of climate change in some environments than others. This is largely driven by socioeconomic factors, but not entirely. And therefore, someone living in the Sahel, for example, will firstly be affected by climate change earlier in terms of the severity of impact than someone living in, let's say, Yorkshire, but also the vulnerability of the system is much greater. So the impact on individual lives and on human health will be greater. And the biggest impacts will be those where the climate change effect geographically and the vulnerability coincide. And very many of those, I think, are relatively easy to pick out. But to be clear, the negative effects on health will be everywhere, it's just they will be differential. Now, if you turn to UK and Europe, and I'm going to talk about this largely because that is my current responsibility, all of the things I'm about to talk about are also true globally, but let's just take Europe. There will be direct effects, direct effects are things like increases in heat stress, and we'll see probably over the next week that can be very difficult, depending on where we get to. We saw this, for example, in Paris a few years ago, really very significant impacts on mortality of people with cardiovascular or other risk factors. There will be impacts on flooding, for example, different forms of flooding, particularly surge flooding. So these direct effects will have line of sight impact from climate change through to negative health impacts. But then there are multiple indirect effects, and I've just taken a few of these. Vector-borne, for example, diseases, for example, will change their range. On balance, they will certainly increase the range of many vector-borne diseases, and they will certainly move them around to places where currently, for example, there is limited immunity. And these include mosquito-borne diseases, tick-borne diseases, which include many of the great killers, malaria, for example, a disease I worked on for many years, and many of the viral vector-borne diseases. Then there are a large number of negative consequences of the indirect effects on water systems, ranging from people having too little water to wash their hands, leads to diarrheal diseases, through to impacts on the economy and on different sectors of the agricultural system. There will be indirect effects on the agriculture more widely, including animal and plant health, and these will in some areas lead to food insecurity. Again, that's less likely to be true in a wealthy country like the UK, but it will certainly be an issue in very many other areas. Again, we're seeing that the food economy system in the world is surprisingly fragile. I think most people would not, for example, have realised that a war in Europe would have a knock-on effect to food security elsewhere. This is on quite narrow boundaries. Quite small changes can lead to quite big consequentials in this area. There will, of course, be major global impacts on socioeconomic development, and everybody, I think, would accept that the biggest predictor at both a micro household level and at a macro country level on human health is human socioeconomic development and wealth. So this is going to have very long-term impacts, which will be multi-generational. And of all of these, will have been even greater risk in Africa and Asia. And I've just taken for the UK, but this would be much more extreme if we were talking about, let's say, northern Nigeria. This just happened to come out last week. I thought it's a nice paper looking at heat-related excess mortality now. Where there is excess mortality now will be the places that first see this with climate change. And London, actually, is one of them. Now, what should be the policy responses? And I was asked largely to give views on this, in or with an impact on health. Well, I think there are broadly four, and I'll re-put this slide up at the end. This is essentially my summary of the key points. We have to get healthcare as an industry, as a profession, as a group of activities, define it as you wish, as close to net zero for carbon and other greenhouse gases as possible. It is a significant contributor, not the biggest, but it is a significant one. And the world is full of people who actually say, we completely agree that carbon should go down, but not in my industry for the following reasons, because we're really important. Healthcare cannot be exempt from this. The second thing is that we must promote policies that have, I'm now going to speed up because I'm glad to see that one of our co-presenters is now arrived. That's excellent news. So therefore, right, I'm not filling time that she will be doing things. We must promote, and this is the easiest bit, policies that have co-benefits between mitigation, reducing carbon, and health benefits. We must find medical countermeasures for diseases and conditions which will increase with climate change. Climate change is happening already and will continue to happen. However good we are in the next few years at addressing this, we therefore have responsibility as part of adaptation to address these. And science has a very major role here. And finally, and I cannot stress this too strongly, we must be honest about trade-offs. There is a slight tendency to try and wish away trade-offs because that makes the argument easier. But actually, if you're not honest with yourself and with others about the trade-offs at the beginning, you end up with bad policies, badly designed, and where people feel that they've been sold a dishonest situation because they weren't told about them at the beginning. People need to have both sides of the argument put to them honestly and properly, and science has a major role both in identifying the trade-offs and in then in minimising them. And I'd like to highlight two excellent reports, this one by the Royal Society and then a joint one by the Academy of Medical Sciences and the Royal Society, which actually explore some of the areas where trade-offs occur. Now, just to give, and I'll just, this is three slides, just to flesh out the main points that I've made so far. So healthcare and net zero. Here are some of the multiple ways in which healthcare, and in this case I'm taking the UK, but the same is true in many other countries, probably even greater, for example, in the US, contributes to carbon through construction. Very popular, but the fact is construction can be more or less carbon intensive, but it is still going to produce a lot of carbon as it happens. Heating and, as we'll see in the next few weeks, cooling. Hospitals and clinics have to be warm or indeed cool enough. They have very vulnerable patients who actually cannot go above or below particular temperatures without serious negative consequentials. But they also have to be well ventilated for infectious reasons, for reasons of pollution, a variety of other reasons. That potentially provides a tension if we're also at the same time trying to reduce carbon emissions. I'll come back to this one. Healthcare uses very large numbers of disposables. Very visible, I think, during COVID, but it's true as part of routine service. Again, huge carbon footprints if you aggregate them globally. Taking the NHS, it's a major contribution. The NHS transport fleet is one of the largest in the country. What it does with its carbon emissions has a big impact on transport more generally. And there are specialist areas. For example, some anaesthetic drugs are quite significant potential greenhouse gases in their own right, and there are alternatives which are less bad. None of them are going to be absolutely perfect. The same will be true, for example, for inhalers. So we have to look at this very seriously as an industry, as a set of professions. Then the bit which is, on the face of it, the easiest, promoting benefits, promoting policies with co-benefits. There are some very clear win-wins in this area, and we should celebrate them without trying to pretend that's all the areas. The most obvious, I would say, is promoting active travel. Walking and cycling has multiple wins. You can't go wrong, essentially, in terms of health. It's brilliant for almost every area of health if you improve people's activity levels. And at the same time, it's going to take people out of cars, out of other carbon-intensive areas. So that's an easy one. And you know, we've come from a place, this is just, I put this up because this often assumption is really difficult to do. You know, if you went back to the 1940s, there was huge amounts of cycling. So we're just going back to something which was completely normal for our grandparents' generation, cycling and walking. Loft insulation would be another one. Good, very good thing for elderly people, reduces their bills, second co-benefit, reduces carbon, third co-benefit. It's kind of every time a coconut. Then we come on to more nuanced things, including air pollution. And I'm doing a report this year on air pollution, so I'm kind of wading through some of this at the moment. The switch to electric cars will lead to a reduction in tailpipe emissions, good for air pollution. There will be some other particular matters. NOxes essentially go out of the window completely, and it's good, by and large, for carbon. So that's a kind of co-benefit, pretty clearly. It's not a complete answer, but it takes us some of the way. As the steady move through the Euro standards, as cars are made more and more efficient, one of the ways that they've reduced their emissions is to use less and less carbon. That's good for everybody, essentially. So there are co-benefits. But then there are some ones where there are, reducing carbon use in industry. Again, large numbers of co-benefits. A lot of this is happening at the moment. But then there are some where there are policy tensions. The switch, for example, from petrol to diesel, which was a deliberate policy decision of the government, may have been good at the margins for carbon, but was bad for air pollution. And the two were not really brought together as a single policy. And the use of renewable wood for space heating, some of it in homes, largely middle-class homes, I have to say, and some of it in industry, may be good from a carbon point of view, but potentially is going to produce actually a significant increase in particulate matter air pollution. That is a trade-off. we should be honest about it. The next thing, the third thing that I talked about was science and engineering to reduce but not eliminate health impacts. And here, science is infinitely powerful. So I've talked about the fact we will see an increase in the range of some major vectors. Let's take, for example, Aedes mosquitoes, which are vectors of several major diseases, dengue, Zika, chikungunya, yellow fever, for example. Aedes albopictus, one of the Aedes vectors, is steadily moving up north through Europe. Almost certainly climate change is contributing to that move. And there is a realistic possibility with continuing climate change it'll start becoming established here in the UK. So we've got a vector, but we in scientific terms will probably not be able to get rid of the vector, or at least not easily, once properly established, but we can get rid of the diseases. We already have highly effective vaccines against yellow fever. I think we will get moderate and then good vaccines probably against dengue, Zika, and chikungunya. So we can mitigate the effects of this. Essentially, this is a form of adaptation. We can have medical countermeasures to several diseases. We can actually produce engineering solutions to reduce the health impact, for example, of heat stress, for example, of flooding. Taking agriculture, we can produce drought and flood-resistant crops. These are all within the ability of science to do it. It is not a complete solution, but at least if we identify the problems, we can produce solutions to them that help, to some degree, to reduce the impact. And the final general point I wanted to make was about being honest with ourselves and identifying policy tensions. The worst way to make policy in government, I say with deep feeling, is to think that the thing you want to achieve does not come at a cost when it does. It is absolutely essential that at the beginning you're aware of the cost that's involved and are honest about it with yourself, with those you're advising, and with the general public, and then try and find a way to reduce the tension. And very often there is a way to reduce the tension. But imagining it's not there leads to, in my view, poor policy outcomes. So an example of this, which I talked about earlier, is that the tension between the clear need to increase ventilation in the UK, both to reduce infection, COVID being the most recent, also flu, and the clear need, and indoor pollution in many areas, and the clear need to reduce the excess use of energy to keep temperatures high or in summer low. Those are in tension. The way we generally in winter keep our ventilation good is to open windows and pump up the heating. Well, that works, but you've then got a policy response which improves one thing. And if you go the other way, you end up with a reverse effect. And what I've seen in the last year whilst we're talking about ventilation is large numbers of people arguing passionately in one area of science for increasing ventilation and opening windows everywhere. In another area of science, some equally distinguished scientists arguing passionately for sealing windows and keeping things properly, most effective way of reducing excess loss of heat. And those two have not talked to one another. And we have to bring them together. And there are ways that this problem cannot be resolved, but it can be to a large extent reduced. And I've just given some example, for example, of a cross-plate heat exchanger as just one way of considering this. So my summary, and this is really a framework, is we need to get healthcare as close to net zero as we can. We need to promote the policies that have co-benefits, and there's a sliding scale of those from ones where it's clear co-benefit to ones where it's a bit more complicated. We need to find countermeasures to the diseases that will occur as a result of global warming. It is not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And above all, we must be honest about trade-offs and then seek, as scientists, to minimize them. Thank you very much.